My Black Counts is a podcast series produced by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health, with assistance from WYPR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to My Block Counts, an environmental justice podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow within their communities. My name is Dr. Jacoby Wilson, and today's episode, we're going to talk about important issues around environmental justice. We're going to talk about the upcoming 10th C Symposium, past, present, and future. And before we get started, let me give you a little bit of background about myself. So I am a professor at University of Maryland College Park. I direct the Health, Environmental, and Economic Justice Lab. I also direct the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice and Health. I've been doing environmental justice work for 30 years. I grew up in Mississippi. I got exposure to EJ issues, environmental justice issues as a kid. You know, when I grew up, in Vicksburg, Mississippi, I lived near the river, so I saw myself as a, Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn type, right? But what's important about the environmental justice experiences, I grew up near a major highway. I grew up near a sewage treatment plant. And my mom always reminds me, son, don't forget the landfill. They weren't right by my neighborhood, but they were like half a mile away from the house. I also grew up near a nuclear power plant that my pops worked at. He was a pipe fitter. So, I grew up in areas where you had environmental health hazard concerns, right? And then as a young person, I also had alopecia areata, which is baldness and patches. And so alopecia is an autoimmune condition. So many of you out there who may be Black women may be dealing with lupus. You may have family members who have lupus. It's also autoimmune condition. So, for me, the reason why I got into this space was to figure out what environmental stressor caused me to lose my hair, right? And so growing up near those hazards, growing up with alopecia was a major driver behind me getting into the environmental justice field. But I cannot move forward without talking about my early mentors. I went to Alabama Agricultural Mechanical University, Alabama A&M, in Huntsville, Alabama. I had some great mentors there who trained me up in environmental sciences and ecotoxicology. But I also met Reverend Dr. Benjamin Chavis and Dr. Bullard at an eco conference at Elizabeth City State University. And I met them, I think this conference was in 1996. I was an eco fellow, a minority social institution fellow with US EPA. And at that conference is where I met Reverend Dr. Benjamin Chavis and Dr. Bullard. And that's where I knew I was going to do EJ work for the rest of my life. So when you think about SIEGE, SIEGE is an entity that's focused on empowerment and liberation science. What do I mean by that? We want to use science to empower people. I empower them, not just giving people power, helping them build the power they already have. So we talk about liberation. Many communities are experiencing environmental injustice. They've been disproportionately burdened by environmental hazards and locally wanted land uses, from major highways and byways to landfills, to incinerators, to factories, to chemical plants, to pollution intensive uses where pollution is impacting soil, air, and water quality, but also impacting human health. And so some people have been exposed to toxic trauma, y'all, every day, living in these communities where they've been exposed to pollution. So you want to liberate them, liberate themselves. Right? Liberation science is to use the science to liberate folks from this pollution, liberate folks from environmental injustice, liberate people from environmental oppression, liberate communities from environmental slavery, where they're being used to host these hazards without any benefits. They get a distribution of the harms, but none of the benefits. They get all the pollution, but none of the benefits. They get all the externalities, but none of the benefits, right? So we're talking about making sure the communities get justice. They get distributional justice. They get the benefits of environmental resources. Think about the Justice 40 initiative from President Biden and future President Harris. As we move from a dirty energy economy to a clean energy economy, making sure 40% of the benefits of federal investments go to communities that have been dumped on, that have been left behind, that have been invisibilized, right? Making sure it's procedural justice, that the law applies equally to all communities, regardless of their race, of their class, of their income, their religion. Making sure that folks get intergenerational justice. There's so many communities who've dealt with disinvestment, divestments, and segregation. So you think about liberation. Liberation, how do we build communities back up? How do we make sure those generations of folks have been left behind, that we make them whole, right? How do we make sure that when we have new policies, when we have new initiatives, that there's representative justice, that the community's voices are heard in the process, that they're driving it, that the work is of the community, for the community, and by the community. That's what we do. And what's the purpose of My Block Counts, this podcast? We're about taking a deep dive into these environmental issues across the Mid-Atlantic region, across the state of Maryland, across DC, across Virginia, across Delaware, you know, other Mid-Atlantic states, Pennsylvania, you know, New Jersey, New York, across America, right? There's environmental injustices, climate injustices, energy injustices across our country, and making sure we shine a light on those issues and providing a voice to those communities who are doing the work, right? Those authentic frontline, fence line, grassroots organizations who are doing the work every day, doing yeoman's work, doing God's work, doing work to empower folks, right? Doing work to liberate folks. That's what this podcast is about. Every neighborhood should have clean air, clean water, safe housing. Everybody has a human right to clean air, safe water, safe food, safe housing. And so we want to make sure in this podcast, we're educating folks and getting an opportunity to learn about how to make that happen so we can achieve justice where we live, where we work, where we play, where we pray, and where we learn. So in this episode, we're going to celebrate a major milestone for SIEGE. It's the 10th SIEGE Symposium, the 10th Environmental Justice and Health Disparity Symposium. For over a decade, this event has been the forefront of tackling pressing issues of environmental, climate, and energy justice in the DMV, in the Mid-Atlantic, with a focus on health issues, y'all. With a focus on health disparities, with a focus on health equity. This year's theme, again, is past, present, future. 10 years of honoring the past by protecting the future. Throughout the symposium, you're going to hear from icons in the environmental justice movement. You're going to hear from trailblazers who've been fighting for decades for environmental justice, like Dr. Beverly Wright, who's going to be one of our keynote speakers on September 11th. Like Reverend Lennox Yearwood with the Hip Hop Caucus, who's going to speak on the 12th. Mustafa Santiago Ali with the National Wildlife Federation, also a member of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, by the way, my frat brother, on the 13th. And then Vernice Miller Travis, again, on that Mount Rushmore of environmental justice, who helped to co-found We Act for Environmental Justice. She's going to speak as a keynote speaker on the 14th. They'll be sharing their insights and experiences, helping us reflect on the past, what we're doing currently, and how we plan for the future of this environmental justice movement. Where do we go from here? This event will feature a range of panels, discussions, and workshops covering topics like climate change, environmental health, energy justice, policy issues, Justice 40, funding, y'all. It's going to be a big part of our meeting, talking about all the federal funding that's out there to help you address your issues. If you're a frontline community, this event is for you, because those at the front line should be at the front of the line when it comes to getting this money. It's your money. It's the people's money, right? The Inflation Reduction Act is about the people. The Bipartisan Infrastructure Law is about the people. So the people most impacted by these injustices, the people who've been left behind by these injustices, should be getting this money. It's your money. So we're going to talk a lot about getting federal funding to address your environmental justice issues. So it's going to be a great chance to network with other community leaders, with other activists, with other advocates, with professionals who dedicated their lives to working on these issues, who dedicated their lives to advancing environmental justice, to advancing climate justice, to advancing energy justice, to making sure we take care of our children who are living in spaces where they may be exposed to toxicants every day, to our elders who may be living in spaces when they've been exposed to heat stress every day, right? When you talk about climate change, y'all, it's impacting all of us, but it's impacting some of us more. And it believes in you a lot more if you're Black, if you're brown, right? If you're low income, you don't have a lot of resources, right? If you don't have a voice in politics, it believes in you a lot. If you live in a floodplain, if you have not the best housing situation, climate change is coming for our vulnerable populations more. So we want to make sure in this event, we're talking about those who are most impacted by climate change and giving them tools to fight back. They're giving them tools to fight back against pollution, giving them tools to allow them to get that money, their money, to address their issues. So stay tuned as we dive into this very exciting, you know, podcast episode and what you can look forward to at this 10th Siege Environmental Justice and Health Disparity Symposium. So today we're joined by some of our Mid-Atlantic Climate Action Hub and U.S. EPA Region 3 Thriving Communities Technical Assistance Center partners. So what is MATCH? MATCH is a center that focuses on helping communities build the capacity to address their environmental and climate justice issues in the Mid-Atlantic. That includes D.C., Delaware, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, also New Jersey. And then in U.S. EPA Region 3 TICTAC, that's a center that focuses on helping communities build the capacity through technical assistance to address their environmental and energy justice issues. So MATCH in many ways is the foundation of our Region 3 TICTAC, and a big part of our TICTAC and MATCH are our community partners. Again, our frontline, fence line community partners who are doing that work to engage, do outreach and engagement of communities that are experiencing these environmental, these climate and energy justice issues. And so we have partnerships with these organizations, right? And so these partnerships help us amplify our collective impact, but also help us develop, share, implement innovative approaches, innovative community-driven approaches to tackle the challenges that communities are dealing with these issues face every day. So at the coming symposium, these partners will be presenting as part of various panels, sharing their stories, talking about the impact of their work, and sharing how they made a difference on the ground, how you can make a difference on the ground in communities, again, who are struggling with air pollution from traffic, who may be struggling with air pollution from chicken farms, who may be struggling with air pollution from incinerators, who may be dealing with physical stresses like heat, y'all, because they live in an urban heat island, who may be dealing with other issues related to climate change like flooding because of extreme precipitation, and they live in an area with poor stormwater systems, that flooding happens all the time. And think about the communities who are dealing with all those issues at one time. And they may have other issues inside their homes, like lead issues or issues around, you know, off-gassing of paints or indoor air pollutants like particulate matter. And it got the outdoor air pollutants too. So we're going to hear from these communities who are doing this work, again, and how they're making a difference on the ground. So this collaboration with our hub partners is essential to making the TICTAC successful and making MATCH successful. And again, all of our hub partners, they are experts in what they do. They are the contextual experts. So we want you to hear from them because we are uplifting community-based organizations who are at the front line of all these issues, who are doing work to create, you know, local change, but also systemic change. So stay tuned as we dive into, again, all these exciting updates in this really important gathering, the Tent Siege Environmental Justice and Health Disparity Symposium. So whether you're new to the EJ space or have been with us from the beginning, if you're new to this podcast, we're really excited to have you join us in celebrating over a decade of progress and setting the stage for environmental justice, the future of environmental justice in the DMV, in the Mid-Atlantic region, in many ways, contributing to the EJ movement across the country and also globally. So first, I would like to welcome Wakaria Poole, Director of Centro de Apoyo Familiar. Also, our second speaker of the day will be Queen Shabazz, Founder and Director, United Parents Against Lead. And our final speaker will be Michael Payan, co-founder of Sussex Health and Environmental Network, SHIN, and Centers of Eastern Shore Health, SESH. So welcome to My Block Counts. Today, our first speaker is Wakaria Poole with Centro de Apoyo Familiar, CAF. It's a community-based nonprofit that serves low-income Latinx and immigrant families throughout the Washington, D.C. region, including Prince George's County, Maryland. The organization uses collaborations, its faith-based network, and a community transformation model to empower Latinx families, communities to improve access to food, jobs, businesses, housing, and other key health resources. The goal of CAF is to improve its clients' access to these, you know, basic amenities and make sure that everyone that they serve has good health. So Wakaria is not only director of CAF, she's also the state chair of the Maryland Environmental Justice Coalition, which is the state table for the Mid-Atlantic Environmental Justice Coalition. She's also the lead for CAF on the TIC-TAC. She's also the lead for Centro de Apoyo Familiar for the Mid-Atlantic Climate Action Hub. And she plays an important role also as a part of the CHARM Center, which is based at Johns Hopkins University. So welcome, Wakaria. Say hi to our audience.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wilson, for the invitation. It is my pleasure to be here today.
So it's great to have you today, Wakaria. So first question. So you've been working with CAF, and CAF does a lot of work to increase home ownership rates among Latino families. What are some of the most common obstacles Latino families face in the home buying process? And how does your organization assist in overcoming those obstacles?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, we are a HUD-approved counseling agency. We've been certified by the Department of Housing and Urban Development now for the last 17, 18 years. And some of the work that we do to mitigate those barriers is education. A lot of the people don't know what they're signing when they go through the process of homeownership. And if you remember, many of you, back in 2008, 2009, we have a huge crisis in housing. And a lot of people that were going through this foreclosure process were because they never knew why they were signing. The fine lines sometimes were making those families get into predatory loans that eventually took them to lose their homes. So part of the work that we do is bringing the education. We provide the home buying education seminar. It's about 8-hour seminar with experts in the housing field that allow people to ask questions and understand what are their rights, what are the things that they have to be, you know, thinking about when buying a home. In addition to that, we provide a one-on-one counseling, which allow people to really work on their credit. We try to make sure that people understand what is the best time to buy it when it comes to having good credit, but also at the same time, you know, how much money you need to save in order to buy a home. What are the questions that you need to be looking at, the locations where you're going to buy? So we guide them very closely. We're not a lender. We're not a realtor. We are someone that is there to work with the family to ensure they don't, first, they don't end up in predatory loans. Second of all, they know the process of home ownership. And then third, that they have access to the down payment assistance program that a lot of the state and county have, that sometimes people don't know that they can qualify because they're first time home buyers. And so we allow people to really go through this process, understand, be educated. And in case something happened with their finances later on, they need to be prepared. What are the process or what are the actions they need to take so they avoid any foreclosure?
Oh, thank you for that. So, I mean, I think home ownership is a way to build wealth, right, in this country. So it's very exciting to hear that work that y'all are doing, and you've been doing this work for, you said 17 to 18 years, right?
Right.
So think about the impact. So again, everybody on this podcast, we're highlighting organizations that are having real impact in communities. Okay. So next question for you, Wakiria. How do you ensure that the financial literacy programs offered by your organization are accessible to families with varying levels of education and language proficiency?
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the things that we have done is that we work very closely with the faith-based community. So CAF partners with closely to 400 faith-based organizations throughout the region. Why do we work with them? Because those are trusted places that people go to, especially the hard-to-reach communities. We ensure that they help us, the churches help us to do outreach and bring this education, especially financial literacy, to the community. That is key. A lot of our community members, unfortunately, they don't know sometimes what, they don't know their spending. They don't know how they can save. They don't know their credit. They don't know that, a loan might be more expensive to them because of their credit score they have. So management, financial management is key. And so we ensure that we bring this information to community members using even the promoters, the promoters program where we do community workers bringing this information. We do train the trainer because we ensure that this information can continue to be available to the community. Even if we're not there, community will be educated. Everything that we provide is bilingual. So we have the opportunity to bring this information to the community in a bilingual way. And we also have a structure, the financial literacy for age appropriate. So we start with, young kids, teenagers, adults, elders. Everybody faces different challenges when it comes to financial management. So we try to really address what the needs are at the ages that they're going through.
With the rise of housing insecurity, particularly, during the pandemic and, we're supposedly post-pandemic, even though we know there's variants out there right now, people are still getting sick from COVID-19. How has your organization adapted its services to better support Latino Latinx families and maintaining their homes?
Yeah, through the pandemic, we were able to really provide more information virtually. Although we did find some challenges that our community, unfortunately, they needed digital literacy. And we tried to adapt into providing basic computer literacy in different neighborhoods. And we continue to do, again, we partner with the churches and we ensure people have this digital training. And so they can understand the process of getting access to a lot of virtual opportunities. And so we have done that through using Zoom programs. A lot of our classes, we do it in person, but we also have it available virtually. And so we also go to the community so they know they don't have to deal with transportation. They don't have to deal with some of the challenges, sometimes childcare. So we use those community places like churches and we bring the information over there. We bring the worship there. Or we make it also on demand where people can just log in into our website and take the classes if they want to do it.
Just kind of a follow-up. So how are y'all addressing challenges that immigrant families face in accessing public services, particularly in the areas of housing and financial assistance?
Yeah, that's continued to be a challenge. It's not enough housing. That's one of the greatest things that we see happening over and over. Unfortunately, for the immigrant community, some of them, they don't have credit built. And some of the things that we see happening, a lot of landlords, they ask, I need to see your credit, credit history. Unfortunately, they don't have a history. We need to start helping them build that up. Sometimes they have the challenge of the language. So we have to kind of mitigate and help them with translation, making sure they can look into that. And again, in general, even the English speaking and the non-English speaking, they're facing the same thing, is there's the lack of housing out there. We don't have a lot of inventory. And so that's some of the things that we advocating for the community. We're working with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, but also DHCD here locally and the governor. How can we get more housings built so that we can mitigate this issue? Even for homeowners, we got tons of people that are ready to buy a home, but there's not enough inventory, especially that is affordable for the community to buy. And never mind rentals, you know, there's not enough rentals available. And so the way that we do that and the way that we mitigate that is, again, making sure that people are ready. Whenever an opportunity comes, they're ready, especially with their credit. We try to build credit for them. We try to fix credit for them. And we try to ensure to connect them with any opportunities that out there, even if they have to drive a little farther, which is something that we're doing. We're asking people, you know what, maybe you need to get a driver license so you can drive, get a job, and leave whatever we have houses available. And that's how we see it happening.
Okay, cool. Thank you. The symposium begins coming up September 11th to the 14th. You're going to be moderating two sessions. So you have the immigration, human rights, and environmental justice session. And there's a panel on environmental justice, Latino, Latinx populations in the Mid-Atlantic region. Could you share what are the themes that will be covered in this immigration, human rights, and environmental justice session, and also the theme about environmental justice, Latino populations in the Mid-Atlantic region for our audience?
Thank you for that. One of the things that we want to bring is more awareness into the Latino community. We want to get them more engaged and active in these issues. And so, and also connect them in a way that it makes sense. Yeah, human right and environmental rights is something that we want to make the connection so the community understand where we're coming from and give them the basic, but also at the same time, give them the opportunity to really come out of this symposium empowered, ready to take action. We want to make sure that the Latino community get more engaged in these issues on environmental justice. But for that, we need to connect them with topics that make sense for them and topics that they're more familiarized with. And how at the end of the day, it is all connected. Our goal in this event is to ensure that we can increase more promoters, more community health workers. We want to make sure that we have more institution adapting and getting language access for the community. We want to get more youth connected to opportunities to be engaged, involved, but also educated on this issue. And at the same time, we want to all the community to understand and reflect, how can we better serve the Latino community? How can we better engage, and how can we get them connected on this issue in a more intimate way? Those are tools that we're gonna be able to provide to those who are already working on the environmental justice movement. How can you better serve the Hispanic Latino community? But then vice versa, how the Latino community can be more engaged and accessible and also connected with the issues that are directly affecting the community where most of the Latino live, pretty much.
Well, thank you for that. And so for our last question, I want you to talk more about the Mid-Atlantic Justice Coalition MAJIC. So what do you look forward to in this session? What will y'all be covering this session? Welcome to MAJIC. Where we are now, and where do we need to go?
Thank you. No, that's definitely something that we want to give a continuation of what we presented last year about what MAJIC, this coalition, is doing, how other organizations can be involved, not just organizations, but also individual, if they want to be part of the coalition. We believe in the power of unity and working together. And MAJIC has been building this voice of the frontline community and also making sure that all the agencies that are dealing with issues on environmental justice related work together to push legislations that are directly affecting the community. And this is a very diverse coalition. Right now, we got over 45 agencies that are part of it. We want to grow it. We believe that government agencies need to know who we are. We want to make sure that community agencies know who we are and how we're working together. We also want to know and share with people how we're fundraising to really ensure that we can continue the movement, continue to build this movement. And so the Magic Coalition is something that is being built to continue. And we need everybody's support. We need everybody to be engaged and connected in order to take it to the next level.
Excellent. Thank you, Wakiria. Thanks for that great overview of the excellent work that your organization, Central de Apoyo Familia, is doing. Thank you for all your leadership. You know, with MAGIC and with the U.S. EPA Region 3 Thriving Community Center Assistance Center, TICTAC, and also all your work with the Mid-Atlantic Climate Action Hub. And just, again, thank you for your time today to celebrate your organization, but also to let everybody know out there who's listening about an upcoming SEED symposium. And again, for everyone, symposium is about the past, present, and future of the EJ movement. But again, there's no EJ movement without community. And you just heard from one of our community partners, CAF. So thank you again, Wakiria.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, everyone.
Next up, we have our second guest today on the My Block Count podcast, Queen Shabazz. Queen is with United Parents Against Lead. UPAL is a national networking organization for parents of children poisoned by lead that works to end the threat of lead poison and other environmental hazards through education awareness, advocacy, intervention, resource referral. UPAL's mission includes increasing awareness and providing education and training to prevent childhood lead poisoning and other environmental hazards. UPAL's founder and director is Queen Zakiya Shabazz. Her work began in 1996. When she discovered that her young son had been poisoned by lead, prompting her to establish UPAL. The UPAL headquarters is located in Richmond, Virginia, and operates the Community Resilience Hub and Arm in Arm Hub in Petersburg, Virginia. UPAL also has an EJ Youth Academy, which has been designed to bring youth to the forefront of the fight for environmental justice. Participants learn the importance of collaborative problem solving, how to identify and engage community partners, and the creation of plans of action that will address identified environmental hazards. So as we talked about earlier, everyone, environmental justice is about representative justice. It's about procedural justice. It's about distributional justice, but it's also about intergenerational justice. So I want to welcome Queen to the mic. Queen, say hello to our audience today.
Good Tuesday, everyone, and glad to be here. Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
Well, it's great to have you here, Queen. So first question for you, can you, you know, talk about lead poison? We know lead poison remains a critical issue in many older urban communities. What specific strategies has UPAL employed to hold landlords and local governments accountable for unsafe housing conditions and hold them accountable to address those unsafe housing conditions that lead to our children still being poisoned by lead?
Yes, unfortunately so. My son, as you said, was poisoned in 1996, and 30 years later is, I would not have imagined that I'd still be fighting that same battle. Just think of Flint, Michigan, you know, which is a recent occurrence that poisoned upward of 10,000 children and families living in Flint, Michigan. So early on, one thing we did, you know, we've had to first educate doctors, you know, based in Richmond, Virginia, because they were not routinely testing children. So that was the first thing we had to do. And then to make sure that children that were receiving Medicaid were eligible to be tested and then to be treated. And then we worked to incorporate the Title X lead disclosure law to make sure that slumlords and landlords weren't just repeatedly poisoning families. You know, children of low income or lower wealth, especially, would move from one house to the other. And it was the same thing. So we went after the landlords to make sure that they were held accountable and had to disclose whether or not there were known lead hazards in their homes. So we're addressing lead in the paint, which was the primary issue of primary way that children were being poisoned. But UPAL has worked to also show the other sources And thinking the Flint, you know, the lead in the water, lead in our soil. So where our children are working and playing and learning, you know, they're being inundated with this unseen hazard and the many harms that, you know, that's caused by lead. And more recently, we've gotten funding to address the lead service line replacement. UPAL is a member of the Lead Service Line Replacement Collaborative. And one of the founding members, and we are working to make sure that all of our infrastructure, the old infrastructure, is changed out, and that our families are not tasked with paying for these problems that they didn't create. So lead service line replacement, that they are fully replaced from the homeowner side as well as the city side, and that funds are made available to help to pay for those replacements.
Yeah, thank you for that. So for the audience, what happens, you got the public line, which is a line, you know, outside your home. There's been, you know, lots of progress there. But then you got the private line. That's a line, you know, from the outside part to the inside of your home, right, Queen?
That's right.
In a lot of cases, folks get left behind having to pay for that. If you're someone who may, not say in every case, but many folks who are dealing with that type of, switching of infrastructure may not have the resources to do that. So you end up having an injustice in the fact that we're requiring folks to pay for that private line replacement. So as Queen just said, they're working on the full, doing it holistically, doing it comprehensively. So that's how you're going to address, I mean, in many ways, this lead issue is not just an EJ issue, it's a public health issue. But that's going to be the way we protect our future generations, right, Queen, by doing that full replacement.
And that's correct. And not putting the burden on families, you know, to pay for that. So there's funding available where up to $2,500, at least Richmond was doing, along with the public water utility company. You know, because as you said, my block counts, my life matters, and our quality of life matters. And lead robs children of the quality of life. You know, it causes permanent and irreversible brain damage.
Exactly. So thank you for that, Queen. So for everybody who's out there listening, if you're going to make sure you can protect this future and think about the theme of the symposium, which we're going to get to, you know, the past, present, future are our children. If we're going to protect them, one of the things we got to protect them from is lead. There's no safe level of lead, right?
That's right.
That's no safe level of lead. So let me get to this next question for you, Queen. How do you engage and empower parents and communities where there's a lack of awareness or denial about the dangers of lead exposure?
Yes, well, I'm glad you asked that. We are partnering now with a local organization called 1619 Inc. And this organization has a big red fire truck that is used for advocacy. So we are rolled up on a community, park there, have food, have some edutainment. So to attract the people to come out, and we hand out this information, we disseminate the information, but then we go a step further to be in that liaison between the family members and the water utility company and plumbers, and putting all of the pieces together so that they don't have to be overburdened with, you know, trying to figure it out, trying to sort out the system, trying to jump through all the hoops that are sometimes put in place for us just to get to safety, just to get to a safe place. So we serve as that liaison to put all the pieces together and say, okay, to make sure that that water is tested. And if it comes back positive, to make sure that they are assisted with filling out the application, that they are able to solicit a plumber, a licensed plumber, to come and do the replacement and work with them throughout those steps until it's complete.
Thank you for that. Can you share, and I think you just did it, but can you share a successful example of where your advocacy led to a significant policy change or enforcement action? Negligent property owner, for example?
We've got several of those. We've had some property owners that we saw jailed because they were repeat offenders with the, you know, contaminated houses. And since several children were coming through and they lied and said that they had disclosed whether there was a known lead in the property. So we've seen some, you know, jailed. And one of the things we wanted them to do is just to stay in that same slum house you know, just staying there for a month.
Yes, ma'am.
And if you would see some of the homes that, you know, where lead was not the only issue, but they had mold, they had holes in the walls, infestation of rodents that, you know, that no human being should have to live in. So we wanted to sentence them, the landlord, to stay in their own homes. So we've done that. We've also worked with, I was a member of the Senate Joint Subcommittee studying lead poisoning prevention under Senator Lambert. Worked with Congressman Donald McEachin and the EJ for All Act, which he spearheaded. Mm-hmm. And that's being continued by Congresswoman Jennifer McClellan, who represents the 4th District since, you know, since his passing.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, so we've been active and everything has tied back to lead, but also, you know, environment justice as a whole, you know, following the EJ principles, the Jimenez principles. And one thing we were able to do in Virginia was to institute, we drafted and saw into law the EJ for All Act of 2020. And I believe we were one of the first states to effectively commission our elected officials to take our draft and make that into law. So the EJ Act for 2020.
That's powerful. When we do have a lot of states that have state level, of course, California is one of those states, but the fact that you have a Mid-Atlantic state, you made that kind of progress. That's commendable. Because you think about the cumulative impacts bill that was passed in New Jersey, and that's been passed in New York. But yeah, I think what you've done in Virginia is definitely a template for other sister states in this region to follow. So, I mean, again, yes. Everybody who's listening in, this is the impact, the authentic frontline, fence line. I want to just emphasize that EJ is about community, right? Representative justice, recognition of justice. Those are most impacted should be driving the work. So you're hearing from Queen, someone was personally impacted, a child personally impacted by lead, but been in this fight since then. And the impact, as she just outlined, she's been having at the local level, the state level, and also beyond in this region. So I just want to, you know, make sure that you're getting your flowers, Queen, for all the great work you've been doing, not just for your own family, but the larger family that you've been fighting for.
Yes, sir. Thank you, brother. That's right, because it's for all children. We, like you said, we don't protect our children. We don't. What future do we have? You know, who do we pass the torch to? And in that vein, you know, I've also served as a mentor for young climate leaders for change, who and also for young Black climate leaders. We recently were chauffeured, and it's hosted by Brother Omar Muhammad in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, work with all these youth. So that made me feel kind of good. Bernice Miller was our keynote speaker there. And that made me know that, you know, the future is bright. We're putting it into some good hands because we have these youth. And I do work with the youth as coming as a member of the EJ Academy, because we have to nurture them. We don't have a right to deny them a future. You know, the future is not ours. To withhold from them. And so that's a very important part, is that our youth are present and that their voices are heard, and that, you know, the decision making, they're in the part of the decision making process.
You know, thank you for that. And just to give a quick shout out to Brother Omar Muhammad, one of my colleagues, peers, brothers in the EJ movement that I work with and still work with, and that's what I used to, down in North Charleston, South Carolina, fighting for environmental climate justice for communities and doing a lot of work, as Queen just said, with youth. We're doing a lot of work with Low Country Alliance for Model Communities and also CCRAB, the Charleston Community Research to Action Board. We'll give Lamsey and CCRAB a quick shout out. So let's get back to a few of the questions for you, Queen. So as you just said, this fight against lead is ongoing. We gotta, you know, support our young people who, you know, may have been exposed, may not have been exposed, but they, as you said, they are the future. So what are some of the most recent developments in your advocacy work, and how are you keeping up with the evolving challenges related to lead exposure, particularly if you bring in issues around climate change? Go ahead, Queen.
Yes, well, we established Virginia's first solar-powered plus battery storage community resiliency hub, and that's actually will be the topic of our panel, you know, during some symposium. We are in the city of Petersburg, which sadly, you know, they lost a $1.1 million HUD grant. Then our organization won a $2 million HUD grant. So it just shows that The community organizations are the ones who's doing the work, which I think you said earlier. And we want to make sure that these funds are put into the hands of the community controlled funds. I also serve on the GHHI advisory board, and it was with Ruth Ann Norton. I worked with her many, many years ago to make sure that the lead disclosure law, you know, got passed. But yesterday at the Resiliency Hub, we hosted 50 members of Region 3 organizations to roll out the Thriving Communities Fund. So we had the people there to learn about it, and it was very, very well received. But, you know, we can have all these sessions, but if we don't effectively make the application so that our people can even look at them, can get through the application, to writing the application, to submitting the application and getting them funded, then, you know, it does us no good to have all these meetings if the funds are still being separated from where they need to go. So that was, one of the things that, you know, I wanted to say, and also an advisory board member of the National Grant Makers. So being in these spaces, being with, you know, with MATCH, a member of MATCH, and making sure, again, that funds get to the communities, that has, where my career has led me, you know, from just being a advocate and for just being a support group, but to actually doing remediation of homes. You know, with that $2 million HUD grant, we were able to remediate 100 homes in Petersburg and Richmond and other localities in Virginia. But that's just a drop in the bucket. Just like when people hear about the community change grant, ooh, $20 million, it sounds like a lot, but look at the problems and the issues that we are addressing. So it's not enough, you know, it's not enough. And then when you take it and you make it difficult for the communities to access it. And so we still left with the problems. And that is the change that I'd like to see.
No, thank you. That's a powerful comments from Queen about, you know, this issue of distributional justice, y'all. So the folks who are most impacted should be the ones getting the dollars. But how you make sure that an unjust system can't get us justice? So you got a system where people can't actually apply. It's so difficult even getting the system to be eligible to apply. It's difficult to apply to get the money, and then the community may not have the capacity to manage the money. How are we making sure we're putting the systems in place so we can make sure the folks who've been harmed the most, who've been left behind the most, who've been poisoned the most, who dealing with trauma the most, that we make them whole, that we heal, that we rejuvenate them, right? So I want to give a shout out, you know, to President Biden and Vice President Harris for Justice 40, for the billions and trillions of dollars out of the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law. But in the words of Dr. King, you know, bend the arc towards justice, right? We're bending the arc, but that money is a drop in the bucket, as Queen just said. Not enough money to address the issues. So these communities, they need more money, but they also, we need to make sure we have systems in place to make it easy for them to access the money that they need to make themselves whole, to repair the community, to heal their communities. So that's one of this, the co-sign of what Queen just said. So Queen, let me move to another question. You talked about the symposium a little bit already. Can you go into a little bit more detail about your session that you're going to have at the symposium? And then just what it means to you, I mean, as a community member, to be at the symposium. What kind of impact has it had on you? And what kind of impact can it have on others?
Yes, I encourage all the listeners to attend the symposium, try to come in person, attend the virtual sessions. The impact that it has had on me is I've learned so much, learned of so many similar communities or communities that's facing similar issues as mine. And that has strengthened me. That gives us, you know, the unity, the strength and unity to know that we're not fighting these fights alone. And also when we see a community that has succeeded in overcoming those barriers, like, you know, for instance, here in Virginia, we were able to stop the Atlantic Coast Pipeline situating a compressor station in a historic African-American community. We stopped a mega landfill from another historic community. We stopped the Wegmans distribution center from being cited. That battle is still going on, but we're winning some of the battles. So, you know, that strengthens us. And those members have all been invited to symposium, and they came to last year's symposium. I look forward to seeing them again this year, you know, and take that information back with them. Our building is in a historic district, our resiliency hub, and it's on the state and national list of historic sites. So preserving that history, and our building was used as a USO for colored army troops during military segregation. You know, when we can go and fight the war and die with you, but you can't come and socialize and have a drink or a bite to eat with us. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the rule of the day during World War II. So we want to preserve that history and preserve that culture, and no one's going to do it if we don't. So our symposium session features African-American women who have founded or created or started resiliency hubs in their communities. And I am one of those. As I said, Virginia, we are the first one in Virginia, and we have a sister from Delaware and a sister from DC who's going to share, you know, the ups and downs that they've had to struggle with, but overcame in their community. The resiliency hubs are now in existence. So we want to encourage people. That's a lot of talk about resiliency hubs now. And for us to have Black women, just like we're getting ready to have a Black woman president of these United States.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, we're moving and shaking, we're doing things, and that has to be recognized. So I'm just happy to be able to moderate, bring these women together, powerful Black women, to share their insights and to encourage others to make sure that we do what we can do to save ourselves. We're not going to be left on the roof with the floodwaters rising. We're not going to be left out there without a boat. We're going to do what we can do to save ourselves and our communities.
So thank you for that, Queen. Also symposium, we got a session called My Sister's Keeper, and highlighting all the great work of women in the EJ movement. But just again, to give Queen her flowers, she's been a leading EJ activist and advocate, you know, doing yeoman's work, doing God's work, doing work of the people. So I want to commend you for all your great work, Queen, being a great partner. I'm looking forward to the session at the symposium. And so everybody listening, this event is a powerful, as you're hearing, you got powerful people, you know, doing powerful work. Come and talk about building power. Right? How you build power, grow power, and use that power to impact positive change. You've heard Queen outline the positive change she's been able to do as a member, as a founder of UPAL, right? Of UPAL. And, you know, as a mother of a kid who's been lead poisoned, right? But how she's moved forward, and she said earlier in her own words, to help other kids, right? So that, again, is an important part of the work, this intergenerational justice, you know, past, present, and future. What are we doing for our future? And again, our children are our future, right? And so again, Queen, just want to thank you for all the great work. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. Thank you for being a great partner. And then again, looking forward to seeing you at the symposium.
Likewise, and thank you, Dr. Wilson, for your leadership and guidance and paving the way for us to do what we do. And thank you for the two fellows. I can't not go without mentioning my fellows who are helping us with them. We have a backyard lab, garden labyrinth, so they're helping us to build a food forest. And one is helping us to relaunch our environmental justice map of Virginia, helping us with some GIS mapping. So all of those things came through Siege and you. So I couldn't thank you enough for all that you do to open the doors and pave the way for us to follow. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. You're very, very welcome. Thank you again, Queen.
Blessings.
This is My Block Counts, an environmental justice podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow in their communities. Thank you for joining us. See you next time. Dr. Wilson, out.
You've been listening to My Block Counts. My Block Counts is sponsored by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health at the University of Maryland. Executive producer and host, Dr. Sakobe Wilson, with production assistance from Ariel Wharton. Technical producer, Kelly Avent. Additional information about My Block Counts can be found at ceej.center or wypr.org. New episodes of My Block Counts are released each month. Please share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review.